Thanks for tuning in to Jin and Tantra. In this episode, we continue with the obstacles towards one's development, or as we lovingly call it, the 9 things that could fuck up your life, today being number 5. We were specifically talking about the mischievous mind and the meditative techniques to transform it into something more palatable. We further discuss using pleasure as a motivation towards meditation and as a vehicle to get into the core of who you actually are. Enjoy the episode.
Welcome to Jin and Tantra, spirituality with a twist. The podcast that takes Tantrism, Buddhism, Taoism, Sufism, Kabbalism, Shamanism, Chinese medicineism, and all of the other isms we've been influenced by, and blends them into a tall, crisp, cool cocktail your spirit has been longing for.
I want you to get together.
Now, isn't that refreshing?
I want you to get together.
Hey, fellow GNTers, those of us like our spirituality with a twist. Usually there's like a little button for me to hit, but it didn't pop up this time. So I was like momentarily frozen.
Mm-hmm.
Daniel, always changing, constantly changing, rearranging. All right. So we're working on the obstacles. We're in obstacle number 5. And it's an interesting one. We're going to emphasize the idea of being plagued by self-inflicted suffering, but I wasn't sure if you wanted to read it again, Daniel.
No, we're going to read it. I'm going to read it.
Okay, maybe give it a shout out because it's kind of an interesting one, the way it's phrased.
Okay, so obstacles, as we are deeming them, and as in the as what the book says, but we're calling them 9 things that will fuck up your life.
Certainly can.
So this would be the 5th one. So if you've been following along, we did 1, 2, 4 and then 5. We will circle back to number 3 at some point.
On 3, but we didn't finish on 3. 3 was, I think, when we went into our long thing about like Taoism and Confucianism.
Yeah, maybe we started there.
That was 3. That was the start of 3. Yeah.
Anyway, so I'm going to read this one and then to give people the thing. And so again, for those who are, you know, keeping score, that's this book that we're working out of is the Tao of Longevity, the Tao of Health, Longevity, and Immortality, the teachings of Cheng and Le, translated by Eva Wong. So this is the passage we'll be working from. In your youth, you were unwilling to cultivate, and in your old age, you continue to injure your spirit. Even when you lose your vitality and become ill, your mischievous mind still refuses to wake up. Or you were born into hardship and were doomed to suffer all of your life, being plagued by self-inflicted suffering and crushed by a difficult livelihood. This is the 5th obstacle.
So I guess what we pointed out first before we go into like the deeper dives into maybe what will be the heart of the episode was that there's like these 2 different things going on there. And like, to me, it seemed very Chinese to jam those 2 things together where you're kind of like, okay, do they totally belong together? There's a thing in the Chinese medical world where they say that there's 4 examinations, but then one of them is listening, smelling, like jammed together. And you're like, what's that?
Yeah.
Sometimes that seems to happen in Chinese books. I don't know. But it had a little of that vibe to me. And I guess we kind of see, to my mind, I think we acknowledge the fact that there are people who are born in situations that are just extremely difficult, like all the time. I think that was from almost the very first episodes we recorded.
Yeah.
So I feel like we talked about that one a lot with a lot of compassion. And I guess the general position on that would be like where you can try to find your moments or something, right?
Yeah.
It seems to have been the attitude. And where you feel like you can make progress and changes, I guess you try to make them. But I remember that even like some of the, like we were very new pups in this whole thing and we were just recording things during the pandemic. And that was like a major thing we wanted to make clear about, right?
Mm-hmm.
And talk about things that people could do, but with the acknowledgement that there are people who are really going through hard times, right?
And still are. Yeah.
I mean, still are. Yeah. It's still are.
Always.
Yeah.
It's constant.
It's a constant thing. Yeah. Or like in the model that I like, where there's these sort of 4 levels of human motivation, some people are just struggling just to get by in the world, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. That was Jung's quote about like to be normal is the ideal aim of the unsuccessful, which sounds harsh, but what he goes on to really say is like, he means by unsuccessful people who are like struggling hard just to hold shit together. So for them to get to the position where they can feel secure is, you know, their major motivation and accomplishment, you know?
And that's financial, but that's also like with people who struggle with health issues, you know, we're medical practitioners and some people have really bad, you know, things that are, that they've inherited or that they have developed as time has gone on or have, you know, allergies to things or, you know, victims of various kinds of traumas or whatnot. So daily life is being successful in daily life, what we would consider quote unquote successful, is a big win for some people who have a hard time getting up.
Yeah. And like I had a friend who worked really training people with autism, right? That was, he ran a school for autistic kids or was, he didn't run it, but he was the dean of it, you know, like the principal. Took a long time to get to that word. But, you know, like for him, like getting the kids just to be able to kind of function in the normal way. And, you know, those are all accomplishments. So yeah, you can certainly have a lot of compassion for that. Jung's thing, I mean, just to finish that is to go like, yes, but if you're like a person who can be successful in the world and you just stop there, that's not good.
Yeah.
He's calling that out. But otherwise, yeah, if you, you know, this whole thing of, you know, being crushed by the world around you, which they're describing in this Taoist book, it's interesting that they say that, you know, they don't really give much of a remedy for it in the immediate in that chapter either. They're just kind of like, okay, some people are in this situation. You know, if you read the rest of the thing, it doesn't seem that they really talk about what you're supposed to do about it. Not that they talk about what you're supposed to do about any of those things in a lot of detail, but it's just kind of thrown out there, just like, okay. So you're like, okay, some people have it like really tough. So anyways, I think our advice, as far as it could be advice, you know, do people need our advice? I don't know. But as far as we're talking and people might be listening, I think the way we've been talking about the whole time does show like the right spirit and the right heart and the right compassion about it, right? And you feel that way about it?
Yeah, no, totally. I don't know if I've ever mentioned this before to you or on here, but I used to work for this secondary education. It was hosted by National Lewis University, which is like a teaching school here in the Midwest. And they had this program called the PACE program, Professional Assistant Center for Education. And basically what it was like a 2-year post high school, quote unquote, college education for higher functioning mentally handicapped persons. So Asperger's type people, Down syndrome, people who had some, you know, head trauma and didn't get, you know, fully developed and whatnot. And so I taught like the fitness and diet classes for them, how to, you know, choose better foods. Why is brown rice better than white rice for, you know, all these kinds of things, you know? And it really, I mean, I have a soft spot for those kinds of folks in this lifetime, for sure, as I have many soft spots. It's basically only a soft spot. That's all that's remaining, just a bruised plum of a heart. But it really gave to how we're talking about it, gave me perspective. And like you're talking about, you know, just like tidbits of something to think about. For me, the idea that people can use to kind of help themselves through this is perspective. And we'll open that up a little bit more towards the end of the conversation, hopefully today. But that's, you know, like you mentioned to me on the phone, Eric, maybe about a month ago, I think you said something along the lines of like, insight as the motivator for change.
Yeah.
We'll, you know, that's the teaser for the end. So if you could stick around to the end, which is not a lot of people, just throwing it out there at the beginning, like 10% of listeners finish the video or the discussion until the end. So maybe we can tease some folks or trick, however you want to call it, to stay to the finish.
Yeah, it's a little foreshadowing of the cliffhanger. Yeah. All right. So there's a lot of stuff in here about kind of like torturing yourself with your own thoughts and emotions and refusing to wake up.
Yes.
And I wanted to go as personal as I could on this.
Sure.
Because of the torturing yourself with your own thoughts. It's interesting in the notes, because I wrote something about like, it's like literally in the notes when I wrote this thing, because a while ago I said, I was thinking about this past week with someone I consider to be a true soulmate, and anxiety had come up. And in the interim of that, as it turns out, fell in G and tears. fellow GNT or listeners, your friendly, one of your two friendly neighborhood spiritual podcast hosts has had a rough ride these last few weeks. Not been easy. And this person who I was referencing is this soulmate person. Like, it's really funny, but like, cut ties with me, like, boom, you know? And we were like super close, even as far as last Friday and Saturday, as close as we've ever been, but cut. And I was like, so I'm gonna have to like think about what all that means. And I don't want to go into the details of all of that, but I realized as we were doing this episode, I was like, well, I am in the midst of like this. So it's a good time for maybe for me to talk about this kind of a thing, because you know, I got the little internal torture chamber going, right? I'm not able to sleep. I'm not able to eat. All the classic good time parts.
So many good R&B songs about that, Eric.
I know. I'm going to be listening to all of them. Yeah, everybody plays the fool. Sometimes there's no exception to the rule. That's right. I ain't lying. So, and like, it's interesting because like the kind of, I mean, it's been a few weeks of this up and down, and it's been mentioned in episodes here and there in passing. Or Dan and I have talked about it before we got on, and like the kind of thing where it's like painful enough where you sort of just have to accept that you'll probably won't be the same person afterwards or something. Mm-hmm. And we've all been through those kinds of things where you're like, wow, this is really painful. And this is going to change me somehow. Like, I'm just not going to be the same human afterwards. Right. And I know you've had experiences like that. I've had experiences like that, but this is like on that level of like, wow. Cause it was something I thought that I would be close with for the rest of my life or something. And I don't know if I totally get it, but it's not the business of talking about that. I don't know if I totally understand it, but that's the person's own business anyways. And I don't want to dwell on that part, but like, you know, where you're like really in a kind of like where it hurts and it's like affecting you so deep where you're like, wow, this is going to change me somehow. So since I'm in the midst of this, it seemed like a good time to talk about emphasizing the part about what do you do about getting tortured by your own thoughts. And maybe we'd go through and just talk about some like meditative techniques around that a little bit, because I'm going to have to be doing them with some seriousness. So I know we'll go back and forth maybe, right, Daniel? I'll throw some out. You can give me your reactions to it. Yeah. Well, I first thought, and this is in the notes when I first put this one together before I knew I'd be talking about it in this way, but I brought up a couple of things that are from what it's called the Mahamudra lineages. Mahamudra means great seal, and it's part of the kind of Tibetan part of the world Buddhist lingo. And it's kind of a meditation that's a little bit less based. It depends on how you do it. There's different ways. That means different things to different people. But it can be more of a thing where you're not necessarily meditating as much on mandala things or some of the more things that you might associate with Tibetan Buddhism. It can be like different style of meditation techniques. And some of that might overlap a little bit with what you might think of as being more Zen or some other kinds of things like that too, right? Mm-hmm. It's not always as elaborate. Though there's debates of what this means. I got the Mahamudra lineages presented from Gelug Rinpoche. So I want to give a shout out to the late, great Gelug Rinpoche, because he was the one who taught me this. I was up in over in Ann Arbor, you know, kind of spending the week getting the transmission. That's a big deal in the Tibetan world. You get some kind of transmission into a thing. So I did go through this training, right? Though my main practice maybe isn't exactly this. So they kind of say a couple of things about this. I thought I'd throw it like now with the context. So we like to put context. So we did.
Right.
So otherwise, they kind of talk about a couple of big ideas here. One is they can make a comparison to someone who is fighting off someone who's shooting arrows at them. So there's an archer who's perpetually shooting arrows, and you're a swords person, and you're spinning this sword. And as the arrows are coming at you, you just clink every arrow that comes at you by the spinning of your sword, right? As a kind of a technique. So this is a little bit more like a cutting of the thoughts kind of approach to things, right?
Which we've talked about on here before, for sure.
Maybe not with the swords person image, right?
I mean, Manjushri is my homeboy, so you know.
Yeah. Well, it's a Manjushri kind of a thing, right? Yeah, the spinning sword, right, of wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
This is considered to be obviously good. There's ups and downs to it, because it's the whole idea, like, can you keep your sword spinning forever, or can you always catch every single arrow or something like that? So the Mahamudra texts talk about this in kind of an interesting way. It's not obvious, like they're saying it's the best one, but it is a thing you can do. if I look at myself, there are moments like this where you have to go like, okay, I got to cut this thought. These thoughts have to be cut. These thoughts have to be cut. So, and maybe that even that sword image does kind of speak, it taps into maybe a little bit of the martial part of each of us, the martial artsy parts of each of us. All of us have a little of that in us, right? And the part that wants to like function in that way, it's a bit more yang, a bit more assertive or something. What do you think of that as a technique though? Do you do that in your life?
I mean, I do that every day, Eric. I do that every single day, you know, because it is the act of cutting, right? That does the thing, but it's also the act of like, I'll call it whirling, you know,
yeah.
It's also this circular movement that is present. I mean, I don't know offhand of a single meditative spiritual practice that there is not turning.
Mm-hmm.
There is
mm-hmm.
not some turning. Now, this is like very, I don't know, we're going to go so deep so quick, but like people who are listening, they're like, okay, so you're spinning a sword and you're cutting your stream of thought. Yes, on the outside, that is exactly what you're doing. Understand also, this is mental energetic. This is human technology that has been passed down as one of the oldest means for freeing yourself from repetitive and as we're going to call it in the name of this episode, the mischievous mind. So it does not get talked about. This does not get mentioned in unless you're in a very kind of small setting where there are teachers and students who they can pass it down, something like this. So this is being presented to the world kind of open. So our several hundred thousand followers or our listeners, I don't like followers. I don't, you know, and I'm no one's leader by any stretch. I can barely lead myself, you know? But this kind of technology of whirling is present in many, many, many techniques, and it is extremely effective and damn near ubiquitous.
But I feel like when that happens, you can have this moment where it gives you a zone of like mental clarity. As the thought seems to come in, you hack it,
mm-hmm.
right? Or it's kind of a stream. So in that sense, it's probably like a stream of arrows and you're, you know?
Yeah.
And you like kind of clip the stream. And then for a little moment, especially if you're in the midst of something that might be really painful, like, you know, I'm sharing, I'm going through it, right? Mm-hmm. I'm in the midst. So, you know, when you get that, you can have these little moments of like, bang, and you can get these little moments of clarity, right? Mm-hmm. Kind of like in between the arrows or something like that, right? You have these moments where you can try to return back to some more core part of who you are. Does that match your experience of it too?
Yeah, that's in the yogic tradition. This is known as dharana and dhyana. Mm-hmm. Dharana, I think, is the turning of your attention or the focusing of the rays of your attention. And dhyana is the return of your attention to the source of attention, right? So as you're doing this turning, you are creating a kind of a whirlwind, a force field, if you will. And so, you know, we would be remiss if we didn't mention the use of like vajras. In this case, vajra is like a seen as a weapon, or Eric is talking about a sword. And that in many, like, what do you want to call it? Vedic text or even Eastern philosophical text, there's many deities or, you know, enlightened beings that are holding weapons in their hands. And traditionally it's talked about as their weapons to fight off evil, but they're not referring to like, you know, I'm not gonna, Abbott and Costello is the wrong analogy, but like, you know,
yeah, but it's Costello versus the Dracula or the
yeah they're not referring,
that's so old school from you,
right? Well,
those are like 1950s black and white comedians.
Thanks for making a reference, you know.
I was like, wow, man, Daniel went deep. Abbott and Costello, wow. Yeah. That's like who's on first shit.
No one knows that shit either.
No one knows.
I only know it because my grandmother told me, you know what I'm saying? Like
it was a bit, right?
But these images are referencing people who are supposed to be, you know, fighting external evil. But in reality, that's just the imagery. The internals, they're doing this internally. They're using these, you know, quote unquote weapons, not to be offensive, but to protect themselves from their own mischievous mind, from their own attachments, from their own demons in this case.
Well, I mean, like Manjushri's sword is a sort of wisdom, right? It's supposed to cut through delusions, right? Yes, that's the primary idea of that, right? Or the Buddhist goddesses a lot of times will have this, like, they're kind of like little butcher cleavers.
Yeah.
Right. But they're supposed to cut through delusions. That's the idea of it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, so that's the sword one, right? That's mentioned in the Mahamudra thing, right? One way of kind of dealing with the mind, especially when the mind is kind of like flipping out, which my mind is flipping out. Or the other has to do with like this idea of a bird that's released on a boat out in the middle of the ocean.
Yeah.
So the thought is the bird, and the bird can fly around, and you can kind of watch the bird fly around a little bit, but the bird doesn't really have any choice but eventually come back to what you're talking about, the source of where the bird comes from, right? That turning back, right? And in that moment, you get the clarity of like, okay, the bird's coming back, right? It does create potentially a little distance because you could be the person on the boat observing the bird.
Yeah.
As opposed to like, I'm the bird, right? And the bird is the word. Another dated thing.
Throwback references. We're
1970s.
We're appealing to our audience 60 and above right now, Eric. So the demos are changing. You know?
We're not in the primary demographic at all.
No, we're not. We're not. Sorry, Gen Zers. Yeah. We've left.
I think Family Guy did a thing on the bird or
that's
something.
That's true. The bird is the word, right? And they fight.
The
bird,
you know, the word. So. They did that whole thing where they just like, he just goes into it for random reasons. Mm. That show survived this test of time or not. It's kind of interesting. People still watch it. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so like this bird flies out of this boat. And the idea is that, you know, you can just let the bird flutter. You don't do anything with the bird. You're not hacking it with a sword. It's not that kind of story. And then the bird comes back and lands on the boat. And you're like, well, yeah, you have no choice but come back here anyways. So that's more of like, let's just watch it and see it go around. And there was a distance created there, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like we're just saying. And then it comes back because it has no choice but to do that eventually. So that's sort of another version of this. Is that a part of your life too?
Yeah, this is... what do you want to call this? Like a kind of an open focus, you know, sort of meditation where you allow your not like non-attachment, you know, and that you allow the thoughts to kind of come through, pass, bring your awareness with them, follow them through, and then eventually your mind will return. It's mindfulness without effort, right?
I suppose the part that's supposed to be interesting about it is like it eventually has to come to the boat. I think that's the thing.
Yeah.
So eventually all the thoughts have to go back to the core of the mind or something like that, right?
Yeah.
And
so
when you feel the thought go back to the core of the mind, then you found something, you know, then you found yourself on the boat. I think that's the twister on it, maybe.
Yeah, that there is this kind of like a magnetic quality of the mind to itself. And that you don't, you know, so as like a technical aspect, right? In the previous one, you sit on your meditation cushion or you stand or whatever you're doing, you know, you lie down. And you just imagine that inside is a spinning knives or swords and just cutting everything that comes to your mind. And that's what you do. In this one, you provide no resistance. You ride all of the waves of your thoughts till the end of their permutations, only to find yourself having back returned to where you are, as the bird in the middle of the ocean must return to the boat because there's nowhere else to land. So,
or it might be like, again, that's kind of making yourself more like the bird. You might be the person watching from the boat.
Sure, you can, yeah.
And you watch the bird fly around and you're kind of standing there on the boat and eventually realize, well, this, whatever these flittering thoughts are that kind of semi-suck in different ways, they're going to have to come back to this boat anyways where I am, you know?
Yeah.
So maybe different ways of playing that. You know, the other part about it's kind of interesting the way that you're talking about it. For me, going through like in the thick of things, in the heat of the moment, another old song.
Ooh, that's 80s, but, you know, though, I think, right?
I think it's 80s, right?
Yeah.
Was the heat of the moment.
There you go.
They do that on Supernatural, this show I love.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Anyways, so maybe not if you've watched that show ever, but that's getting dated too. But if you look at this kind of a thing, if you're in the heat of the moment, I'm like thinking like, this is stuff that you actually have to do in that moment. Not even just when you're on the meditation cushion. Like, so maybe it's the kind of idea that you practice this when you're sitting there by yourself. Okay, I'm going to work on this part of myself. But then like, can I carry this out into my life? Because otherwise my mind's going to be coming back doing this, you know, torture chamber thing when I'm not in that, right? Because I'm in the moment. You know, show me what my heart meant. I think that's the next line.
But this comes to the larger point. Is that like all of this is a preparation for life. Like meditation is not a cessation of thinking. Somebody was mentioning transcendental meditation. And look, anything that brings anybody to sit down and do mantra or do whatever, I don't hate on it. I really don't. But I could, the analogy that I use, it's like buying a Lamborghini and then only driving it to the Walgreens to get cigarettes and gum, you know, and then driving it back home. And then when you go on the freeway, you hop on your Honda Civic and, you know, that's, and that, you know, it doesn't allow for people to experience the depth of a potential practice that has real roots in it. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. And somebody was telling me about their, one of my clients was telling me about their boss who's been doing transcendental meditation, TM, for many years. And he said he could, quote, stop his thoughts for 12 minutes straight. And I said, okay. And then he's like, well, I would love to do
12 minutes.
He's like, well, I would love to do that. And I said, okay. And I mean, and then what? Now, is that some kind of prowess, something to be proud of? Like, first of all, how do you know it's 12 minutes? Are you timing yourself? And if you're thinking about how long it is, you're having a thought, you know, at that time.
Well, I mean, the whole idea that the purpose of meditation is just to stop your thoughts. I was really relieved back in the Zen thing where they said, like, no, that's not the purpose at all.
Right. And that's my point, is that like, that's yeah, not so
it's like good to get away from that, right?
Yeah, that like there's numerous meditation, like exercise, numerous ways. You could be a marathon runner. You could be a power lifter. You just say exercise. I could meditation. I could be a Zen practitioner counting my breath, or I could be doing this sword spinning thing. On the outside, it looks the same. I'm doing meditation, but you really are not trying to erase yourself while you're there. It's a prepper. It's a deepening of, it's many things, but in a couple points, it's a deepening of your understanding of yourself, capital S, right? The small one in the way to getting to the big one, but in that way first. And then maybe more importantly for people's regular life, because Capricorn, hashtag practical, practicorn, I guess maybe that's, you know, is that it's a preparation for your life. How do you deal with things? So, you know, you got stuff going on right now. Your meditation practice is absolutely informing the way that you are going about what you're going about right now.
Well, I mean, like the deep part is like, what's the point of doing any of this if your life doesn't change? What's the point? It's always been that problem, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like from the minute we started doing these podcasts, it was always like, okay, if you don't actually change, if you don't change your life, rewrite your own story, rewrite your own myth, do things in a different way, then this shit doesn't have any point.
Yeah.
Except for the thing that might make you feel a little bit happier. That is true. Right. And that's a reason to do it too. But you know, like our goal in doing this was the idea, like, yeah, you actually try to transform your life, make a difference. Right.
Yeah. And Eric, you were mentioning earlier about like, you know, having these deep entanglements with people, you know, not entanglements is a rough way of putting it, but engagements, relationships, you know, that could, you know, be really beneficial or really hard in some ways, you know, somebody cuts you off or whatnot. And we talked about this, I don't know if it was last episode or the one before. And I asked the question, why, which, and if I'm listening to this, I'm thinking like, okay, well then don't do that. And you won't have to go through those kinds of things. But I remember what you said, and I'll share it with you as you shared it with me previous. So reflection.
Really? Okay.
You had mentioned that there are opportunities in relationships that arise from potential karmic bonds or moments of deepening of connection, but that the story of that isn't written. And the outcome of that is not guaranteed to be anything in particular, but the ride along that process is ultimately a deepening one for the person, i.e., you know, Shams of Tabriz and Rumi. And so even though the end of it is like a little bit rough shot, you are better for it after you have gone through it, or if not better for it, you're at least you have been deepened, you know, in that way.
I would like to believe in the tantric stories, they don't end tragic. The Judeo-Christian Islamic ones, they end tragic. This culture doesn't like this shit.
Well, I know.
Those stories end bad.
There's always that.
But if you're in like the tantric tradition, they end kind of cheery. So I'll get to that more in a little bit. Like there's a question of like, yeah, I have to ask this question to myself too. Like, is this samsara so thick that it's hard to make these things work? But we'll build to it, right? There's some foreshadowing, and we're maybe we'll talk about some meditations that have to do with sexuality. We can see if we can get more of the percentage of the listeners to continue on or something. All right. So I was going to talk about the pure concentration thing going back, but you kind of got it already. That was what I had as number three. You could just work on like a pure concentration. I think that's a little harder, those pure mindfulness practices, because there's nothing supporting the mind. There's no technique.
Say a little bit more to that, Eric.
Well, if you're just like in the thing where I'm just going to sit and like observe my mind, and your mind is like an unpleasant place in the moment, that's kind of harder.
Yeah, much harder.
You can do it. And a lot of mindfulness stuff is actually kind of like that. It's interesting that those are the popular ones in our culture. Maybe it's because they're torturous. I don't know. Our culture has a fetish with like painful, torturous things. So it's not maybe surprising to me that the painful, torturous, you know, martyring, painful meditations are the one that people are into. But, you know, it's kind of hard to do. People do it. I mean, there are styles of Zen that are like that too.
Yeah.
You know, but they're hard in the sense that, you know, there's not the technical aspect being used. And so maybe in the, like the Vajrayana, some of the other things that we're talking about, some of the yogic things that you were mentioning earlier, some of the Taoist things, they have more technique to try to help you work with this.
Well,
so I don't know. I'm not trying to say when it's good or bad, but I think it is harder in the midst when something painful is happening.
Well, the other part though, Eric, is that yes, there's technique in some of them, but you know, I would be remiss if, and I would be doing my teacher Andre a disservice if I didn't mention the pleasure aspect. And what you're saying is true, in that many of these techniques, many of these practices, they are using difficulty, you know, to deal with one's own mind, which is already difficult to deal with, versus a tantric practice, which takes that and spins it on its head and uses pleasure to try and motivate the person to continue to go forth, because you'll continue to chase things that are feeling good versus constantly dealing with working with things that make you have difficulty, frustration, so on and so forth. You know what I'm saying? And it's not an escapist route, but it's a motivational route, because it's still difficult even when it's pleasureful. Do you know what I'm saying? And so I have a hard time when
I'm getting hyped, because I'm even like sitting up and down in the chair because it's such an important subject.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is we got really deep really fast, and we're gonna have to finish a little early today, so we'll continue next time. But this is a really deep point that you know Andre makes.
We're not gonna finish this one this week. I think we'll have some more on it. Yeah, but yeah,
100%. Yeah, this is a deep point that Andre makes, is that when you're sitting and doing meditation, the results should make you want to come back. You know what I'm saying? You should be doing things that maybe you're not like enjoying in the moment, but there should be pleasure with them in some way as a motivation to get you to return. And then when you feel motivated to return, your practice deepens, you practice longer, your life alters around this thing because it has a greater stake into your life. So it's like, why would I swallow a poison pill when I could have chocolate? You know? Well, that's
almost like Lama Yeshe's like exact words, like use the chocolate as a way of like kind of training the mind.
Oh, look,
I can give you this bitter, horrible tasting thing. I can give you some chocolate. Your mind will be more into, you know,
which is bittersweet. My favorite flavor.
It's interesting. Like when you like, okay, so let me like, then there's a lot of like places to go with it. Let me bounce a little bit to the sexuality aspect of that too. Not sexuality in the sense of even like a partnered practice, though. We can talk about that more maybe over the course of the year, and we're probably overdue to do it for sure.
Yeah.
But more the idea of like, there's lots of these meditations that use sexual energy feelings that you can access within your own system for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just meditatively tapping into those parts of your own nature and being through your own mind, right? And the point of that, which I think the way I've always seen it, and I think we're getting to the same place with this or a similar place, would be like, part of the point of that is the root of your mind is not a torturous place.
Yeah.
The root of your mind is actually a blissful place. And then that's the trickaroo on this, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you can get situations where this is unpleasant, this is unpleasant, this is unpleasant, and then it'll explode into bliss. I've definitely have had those experiences meditatively.
Yeah.
It happens. And then those moments you realize something like, okay, so you could say, well, some endorphins kicked in or something, you know, or something kicked in. But the subjective experience really, especially if it's physical pain, right?
Like
in doing it, takes itself. But when you really kind of look at it, what you really can feel is, no, that's more to the core of who I am.
Sure.
And then you're getting to being like a tantrika, you know, or then you're being more like the parts of the Taoism things or whatever. that tap into the feelings of bliss, right? Mm-hmm. But the feeling of bliss is being the nature of reality, the nature of reality of who you are, mm-hmm. and the nature of reality of what's going on around you is bliss. Now, I did that like an empowerment with Lama Glenn over the weekend, one of our favorite people, Glenn H. Mullen, Lama Glenn. And you know, he goes back to this point too, which is probably why I love him so much as a teacher. But you know, if you turn back to the energy of the world around you, underneath the surface, right? Not the superficial things. Because again, Lama Glenn is saying there's going to be bad experiences. There might even be kind of like bad people who are hurtful or mean or something, right? It's going to happen, right? So, but that's not the point. The point is that you try to turn it back almost on like more like you might say like a ground of being or some fancy phrase like that, the pure nature of reality at its core, outside of this person was mean to me. And, you know, this part of life is really difficult. Outside of those things, the feeling of like reality around you is like blissful. And that's what you're trying to tap into on some level, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a pretty good cure for getting your heart broken or having a disappointment in some other part of life or whatever. That's a decent cure. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
To experience everything through that way. So, you know, that's a different kind of returning too. It's also probably like where you get things in, if you mentioned Rumi earlier, to me that always sounds like that's where he's getting to God or yeah. Allah, right? Yeah. That's bliss. You know, it's not like a mean bearded Saturnian figure that wants to like make you do a bunch of really difficult things
mm-hmm.
that might not even make any sense. But more like the idea of like you're tapping into something that's more like the ground of being, fancy phrase. I think if you're being philosophical, you might say like ontology, fancy phrase, but like just the feeling of like the world around you, the energy of the world around you is like a sea of bliss. And our beloved Bobby T talks this way too, right? He says like, you know, if you can tap into that, and he admits it's like for himself too, it's not always easy.
Right.
But in the moment, that's what you're trying to do. And then that's where the kind of the sexuality things kind of like kick in too. Because these sexual meditations, at least as far as my experience of it, would be something like you're going through, again, outside even like a partner practice, but you're going through and you're tapping into those energies within your own body. And they have ways of visualizing stuff to do that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And some of it's like really simple, like you just meditate on your own ovaries if you happen to be born in the female form in this life or assigned female at birth, for all our trans folks out there too. And, you know, you tap into those and then you can get feelings of bliss, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just out of that part of your physical body, right? And those were the first experiences for me, not in my ovaries, because I'm not in that form in this life. But you can just even meditate just on like your balls and you could feel the energy there.
I like how you leaned in, your balls. That's good.
But I was just like, okay, we're going to go for it.
Yeah.
So, you know, and then you feel that energy and you can almost like circulate it through. There's Taoist techniques for doing this. We'll probably talk about these meditations over the course of the year. You can actually bring those feelings of bliss and almost like pull it up your spinal cord, right? Mm-hmm. Feel it like go through your nervous system, feel like it hit your brain, right? And it's really super blissful, right? As blissful as probably most of the orgasms that any of us are ever going to have in our lives, right? Yeah. Daniel like was talking at one time doing one of these retreats, and there was a number of the women there that I think you were talking to, and they were like, well, this is better than sex most of the time.
I mean, right? The times that I've done these kinds of retreats, the sounds of ecstasy go on for hours, and I'm not, that's not facetious. This is deeply, deeply honest and real. Hours. They go on, the moaning, and the ecstasy goes on for hours. And one woman said, she goes, yeah, I have sex with my husband because he likes it. And I want him to, you know, I still want to connect with him in that way. And so, you know, she's like, but I don't really need it, you know?
Well, I think even with this person I was talking about, you know, where I'm getting my heart kind of torn around a little bit, I was trying to explain something about like what it means to like have this kind of experience, which makes you a little bit more demisexual, as we were talking about with, Phaedra, you want to get the emotional connection, or sapiosexual, you like the intellectual connection, right? So you feel more of those feelings. That's what you want from people.
Yeah.
The fact of just like getting off or something like that, you know, you don't need it in the same way because you can generate your own bliss internally.
Yeah.
That's fun to share that with a partner. Of course, that's a sharing activity then, right? sexuality is then about more sharing rather than like, well, I need this person to give me an orgasm or something like that. Cause it doesn't feel the same way. We can talk about more about that stuff too. Yeah. And I was trying to explain to her, like, I know this seems weird to say, but like my being close with you, this demisexual, sapiosexual thing, outside of anything that has to be like physical, right? Yeah, because we weren't sexual partners. Like me being close to you feels as good as sex to me. Because I want to be close to you. So that's just, we've all had that experience too. Me just talking to you, getting close to you, knowing you is as good as having sex with someone that I don't care about.
Right? Eric, who does that song? I want to get next to you. Is that the Isley Brothers?
Maybe. You're going to old R&B and you're like, yeah, I don't have had that deep cut.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, like, so, you know, that's like, that's a kind of a bliss too, which I think is what I was trying to reference when you get to the alchemical thing. So the Rumi and the Shams, right? That you can use that connection to a person as a thing. But now, you know, we're in the heartbreak stage, so it's a little bit different. But, you know, to get into that feeling of that, you know, that was a major thing for me. And the Zen school I was studying in wasn't sharing that. They weren't focused on that. But I discovered that, like, through Taoist stuff. And I was like, well, screw it. I'm not going to suffer through this fucking retreat. I'm going to, like, do some meditation to generate some bliss so I'm not sitting here in a bunch of fucking pain. But it's a powerful thing to learn how to do, right? And then you're like kind of tapping into this part that's much more blissful, right?
Yeah. You know, there's two things. I know we're finishing up with our time here for today.
This was kind of interesting. We went in the direction that I don't think I was thinking about this ahead of time because I was writing these notes up, but we hadn't talked too much ahead of time. So this was kind of a fun one because I don't think you were expecting, let's go deep dive into these meditation techniques. I didn't, you know, we didn't talk about that.
No, we didn't talk about that at all. Right. Yeah, no, that's it. So I had mentioned, you know, at the beginning of the episode that, like, or when you were talking about using the technique of the spinning of the swords or, you know, cutting of the streams of thoughts, that like that sort of whirling technique, that the drawing in of the rays of your attention will eventually, you know, I don't know, not solidify, but streamline your rays of attention. And then they will, once there's enough movement, then it'll turn back in on yourself, moving towards the actual source of attention in this case. And this is much like what you're talking about, like this, the returning of the bird back to the boat, or however you want to look at it. And I say that, and I will reference our episode with Rory Hiltbrand. I think the episode's called Running Towards Mystery or something like this. He'll come back on because he's really, really smart dude, good guy. Anyways, he brought up in the episode that he used some R&B music when he was in the car with a friend of his who had just recently broken up with somebody. And so he used the kind of metal element of singing to kind of move their anger and frustration into like sadness, you know? And then once they hit that sadness, that like, the yin and the yang, right, of like fire and water, or in this case, yeah, fire and water, or we'll say like, you know, sadness. The opposite of that is joy, right? So love songs are often sad because those two things work. They're on the opposite side, but of the same coin or of the same pole. You know, they're dipoles of the same stick. And so using some technique with repetition enough, even if it's through discomfort, will eventually get you, like you said, to the deeper layers of yourself, which are inherently blissful, actually.
Yeah, that's the part that's the trick. And I think when I was talking about the sword, you went even in kind of an interesting way with it that wasn't what I was thinking when I first wrote the note down, but you were talking about like literally meditating, whirling, right?
Yeah, spinning, yep.
As opposed to a visualization of just seeing yourself, like in your mind, the thoughts are coming at you and the sword person and you're cutting. You went to more like a whirling thing. Mm-hmm. Robert Thurman talks about this too, Bobby T, in this thing of like the whirling. But sometimes, and there are some other ones that I do every day that involve this kind of whirling thing. But eventually what might happen as you whirl, that eventually might just start to fade out into like what they'll call clear light bliss mind, where your mind will start to go, the whirling will disappear, all that stuff will disappear, and you'll just see clear light. And if you can infuse that clear light with a kind of that blissful feeling, that's kind of the tantric sexual feeling, right? You kind of fuse those two things together. Well, then that's a powerful experience because that's kind of the core of who you are.
Yeah.
Right. And then from a certain like Buddhist philosophical point of view, also the core of reality, right? You're in a giant sea of this energy. It just happens to look like the mundane stuff you're seeing around you, right? To you through your eyes. But if you see it from a different point of view, you could see that everything is just divine blissful energy. And that's curative for a lot of stuff, right?
Yeah, totally.
That's good for a bad mood, you know?
Mm-hmm. That's good. Like those are recommendations for a good life.
Yeah. So like, you know, I'm purposely trying to go like, okay, I have to get my mind into that headspace.
Yeah.
Right. I guess we better call it. We got more to talk about with it. Let's do a short episode next time and we'll kind of just do a little bit more on it. Right. Cause there's some little more cool stuff to say. Right.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. Okay.
This is, you know, for the people who listen to this and to who hear this, there's more, there's definitely more. So this episode will be posted and, you know, we always ask for feedback from people, not feedback, but like, you know, input into what you want to hear about. And we would totally love to open this topic up more, even do something live perhaps and get people's live questions. I think that might be fun because this really should be done in a live setting where there's people who can ask questions as they're hearing it, as they're thinking about it. And this changes people, man. These are techniques for like, you know, dealing with life and everything else, but these are techniques to change your software. I know Eric doesn't love the hardware, software, dualistic
gear. No, you're into it. It's grown on me. The only thing about this one, I got to bounce in like a second. So yeah. I'll let you do your outro. But the only thing about it is that I wanted to talk about it now in this personal way, because we want to do this on this podcast to say, hey, this shit's real, you know, for all of us.
Yeah.
And also like to go like, okay, I'm in the midst of this like right now. So here's what I have to do like in the moment. Like, at least we can talk honest about it, right? And I can share like being like right now, right?
Yeah, totally.
And then, you know, then it's real.
Yeah, it's real, right? Yeah.
Then it's
actually,
real.
Right? Actually,
it's live. It's really real. It's not just like blah, 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 right? Yeah. It's real.
Yeah, no, for sure.
I'll tell you, I'm going through it right now. It's real. So I got to do this stuff now. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Eric, as always, thank you for being on the venture with me. Thank you, audience, for listening or tuning in or however you catch us. If you're on the YouTube, you know, like, comment, subscribe. It costs you nothing. It helps us in the algorithm. We definitely appreciate it. You know, if you feel called to share our work with anyone and everyone who might even have a smartphone, which is probably most people above the age of 4 at this point, you know, the full infiltration into your mind is happening. If you're on the Instagram, you know, give us a shout out. If you're on some other platform that I'm unaware of, you know, whatever, say what's up there too. You can email us at jinandtantra@gmail.com. And we'll catch you guys in the next one. For Eric, this is Daniel. We'll see you. Peace.
To get together, I want you to get together. Put your hands together one time. I want you to get together. I want you to get together.